Committee meeting this morning. Welcome everybody here. We have three, I think, quick bills. Just as I say that, I see four people signed up to testify on Senate Bill 228. I think they'll still be fairly straightforward. Let's start with public hearing on Senate Bill 223. Mazin?
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 223 went through the Senate committee once, and it in the beginning was allowing the local governments not to submit budgets according to the local budget law if there was no tax levying authority with that body. As it passed once, it came back from the floor of the Senate to the committee, to Senate Revenue Committee, and that certain clause was taken out. So what it does now, as it stands before you, 223-A, amended in ghost, that it will enforce the local budget law on all local government entities. In the same time, it requires the Department of Revenue to keep those budgets for a year and then pass them to the Secretary of State with no revenue impact on that bill, Mr. Chair, and as it says, minimal fiscal impact because of the requirements.
All right. John Phillips.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is John Phillips of the Department of Revenue. And the bill before you deals with an issue in local budget law. As you have hearings and are having a hearing right this moment and have a process to pass legislation, local governments, and there are roughly 1,500 local governments in Oregon, and many of you have even worked in local governments. And they all have are subject to, the Local Budget Law Act, which is in Chapter 294. It sets out a series of processes whereby you publish notice, have hearings, etc. And this is typically required for all local governments that levy an ad valorem property tax. Last session, a bill was passed, Senate Bill 933, which required intergovernmental agencies, which are those little entities that work with other that sort of work together with a number of different local governments to accomplish a set purpose. They have not in the past been able to levy ad valorem taxes. But last session a bill was passed that does allow them to levy ad valorem taxes on behalf of those the purposes for which they're formed. And this bill would put those intergovernmental agencies that do levy a tax under local budget law. And it would leave those that don't levy a tax not under local budget law, which is currently the situation. So that's what this bill tries to do. And there was an issue on the Senate side because of a reading of it. Senator Dukes had some questions on it, and we met with her and resolved her questions. So she was involved in the original intergovernmental agency legislation back many, many years ago. So if there's any questions I can answer, I'd be happy to.
Okay. Are there questions for Mr. Phillips?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Barnhart.
Sorry. Local budget law, that means doing things like setting up budget committees and going through the notice procedures and that sort of thing, or are we talking about something else?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, that's exactly it. Establishing a budget committee, having a governing body, pass resolutions, hold hearings, provide public notice, allow public input. Exactly that.
And they don't do that now? They don't do any of that now? They do some of it now, don't they?
There is what I refer to as a local budget law light, and it's a section that follows the Budget Law Act, which provides sort of a trimmed-down version. It doesn't require them to necessarily pass resolutions or hold hearings in the same way that all other local governments are required to do that levy a tax.
Last question.
Yes.
Would this cover if they have a small levy that covers one area of their budget, does this law then apply to the entire budget?
Mr. Chair,
and all the pieces of it?
Representative Barnhart, yes, it would. To the extent they levy taxes then for that year, and this bill tries to limit it only to those years in which the intergovernmental agency does levy a tax.
Thank you.
Okay, any other questions? All right, thank you, John. does anybody else wish to be heard? Okay, John, are you... Why don't you stay there? We'll do 229 next. Pardon? Okay. Anybody else wish to be heard on Senate Bill 223? All right. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 223 and open the work session. What's your pleasure?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Scott.
I move Senate Bill 223A engrossed to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Scott moves Senate Bill 223 to the floor of the due pass recommendation. Is there discussion on that motion? Okay, please call the roll.
Representative Barnhart?
Aye.
Berger?
Aye.
Barr?
Aye.
Pass?
Aye.
Hobson?
Aye.
Pass? Berger?
Aye.
Aye. Let's just see if that's Williams coming in the door there. He wants to, before I bang the gavel. No, it was another one.
Bow tie. Right, the sales tax goes through. That wouldn't surprise most people.
Senate Bill 223 goes to the floor with a due pass recommendation. We've got a local government type that would like to carry this. Representative Farr, let's go ahead and pick you up on that. Okay. All right. Senate Bill 229, public hearing on that, Mazin.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 229, also the A engrossed version. It changes the due date for the additional taxes that are owed when a court or a board of property tax appeal decides that the property taxes are due, and as a result of a correction of errors or omissions. And in doing so, this procedure corrects the previous date that used to be the taxes are due when the next year's taxes become part of an assessment. And due at that time. This have left those due taxes by decision in the past late for about 5 to 15 months, depending on which time of the year the judgment comes. The additional taxes at this time are determined to be due in the 16th of the following month after the decision comes out. If those taxes are not paid by the 16th, then they will be delinquent or considered delinquent from the time they were originally imposed. By doing so, this will represent a revenue impact, a positive revenue impact to counties coming from two sources. The first one will be because of the speed of the payments process that will pull them from the future to present time by 5 to 15 months. And the second impact is those added delinquencies and interest that are now okay to charge from the time of the first taxes were imposed. But they're still both small in nature and do not constitute a significant boon for local government.
All right. John Phillips, are you going to give us the history of Senate Bill 125?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee,
I remember.
If you wish, I'd be happy to. You probably remember better than I do. In the center of the page of the handout is the policy question that we're bringing before you in this bill. And I'll give you two really quick scenarios because I know you're trying to get out of here by 9 o'clock.
Oh, it's okay.
Okay.
Take as much time as we need.
First scenario is a homeowner owns a piece of property and they build a home and the assessor doesn't pick up the home for whatever reason. They didn't notice it was built, so they're being continually taxed that property on just the land. Years pass. The error is discovered. correction is made to the roll, and that person then has this large amount of tax that's due and possibly can't pay it. This was the exact situation that occurred back in 99. A bill was brought forward, and that situation was allowed for any people similar situated to have a delay in the due date for that payment. Typically, the roll would be corrected, the house would be added, in other words, and then the taxes would be added, and the taxes would be due on the 16th of the month following that correction. So that could be a very short time frame. So the bill in 99 said, okay, well, we won't make it due that soon. We'll make it due in the next year with the tax statement for the next year's taxes. So it gives them between and 5 and 15 more months to pay and contemplate that obligation. What was picked up in that was clerical errors that occur from the assessor's office. Nobody's intentional error. Property that's omitted, like in the situation I just described. And a third kind of correction to the roll where value is added. And that is where, let's say, a company challenges its value and says, I think the value should be lower. They take it to the board. They take it then on to the tax court, and the tax court makes a final ruling saying, no, the value is actually higher than what the assessor had on the roll. In which case, the roll needs to be corrected to add the additional value and then the additional tax. Now, for that additional part, there has been this is not really a surprise to the taxpayer in that they may have considered the fact that they would lose. But it's not. But the way we're looking at it is it's not a surprise in the same way it is for a homeowner who gets a notice and says, oh, by the way, we missed your house, and so we're going to tax you for the back taxes on that. So this bill is focused on the additional taxes following appeal, where someone has appealed, and all we're doing is bringing this question to you and saying, did you intend in that earlier legislation to fold these in also? And the reason why we didn't catch it is in the bill on page 2, line 36 and 37. Section 4 deals with what happens to property that's added value that's added to the roll after an appeal. And the way you correct those, it says in line 36, the additional taxes shall be collected as provided in ORS 311-206. And that's the connection we missed. So when we had the bill in 99, we corrected 311-206, but we missed the fact that these types of roll corrections are also then connected to 311-206. And I was here, and yeah. You were here, Mr. Chair, and I don't remember any discussion on that, and so we thought we'd just bring that issue before you and see how you wanted to handle it.
Well, as a survivor of the 99 session, I don't remember that we had time to do this with our brave march through the tax expenditure report that year. But I do recall that this was an issue of omitted property and clerical errors, and I can say for this committee that there was no consideration given to the issue you brought forward here, that being a ruling on an appeal, basically, and tax imposed as the result of ruling on an appeal. So it's a new question, I guess, is what it boils down to. Questions for Mr. Phillips. Representative Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess the one thing that concerns me a little bit, I understand the interest that accumulates if you give a long extended time. I'm just concerned, do you think that you've jumped back too far in giving a person to the 16th of the next month?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, we're just the proposal is just to take it to where it was prior to, prior to the bill in 99, and that issue is on the table, I guess, if it's something you're interested in changing. It is something that, for the person that appeals, we would typically recommend. And the value that's in question, you should pay your taxes. Because if you don't, then during the pendency of the appeal, which could be several years, you'd be accruing 16% interest. So that person then typically pays their taxes, and then on the value that the court finds in excess of the amount on the roll, that's the component that you would then owe following the result of the appeal. Now, some companies will place money aside in anticipation of a negative ruling.
Overall, what you're saying, prior to 1999, this was not a big problem. There was a taxpayer who did have a problem and a bill came in 99, but overall, prior to 1999, for most people, this worked.
And if I could add, John, in response to that, yes. And in fact, the problem in 99 wasn't related to appeals. The problem in 99 was related to this omitted property that caught the person by surprise with a huge tax bill.
Exactly.
And the appeals question was never raised as being an issue back in 99. Okay.
And if I might add, Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, sort of all the stars came in alignment for that particular situation because it was a single mother and it was a poor work, you know, a low-paid situation, and there's no way that person could come up with the money. And not that any of us would want to come up with several years of taxes all in 1 year. But that was the unique situation.
As I recall, it was more than $10,000 in tax liability, wasn't it, back in that bill that she was, faced with? $12,000 comes to mind, but I've got no idea why I would remember that.
I don't know.
Okay. Any further questions for Mr. Phillips? All right. Does anybody else want to testify on Senate Bill 229? Okay. We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 229. Open a work session. What's your pleasure?
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Berger.
Senate Bill 229 go to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Berger moves Senate Bill 229 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Please call the roll.
Representative Barnhart?
Aye.
Berger?
Aye.
Carr?
Aye.
Pass?
Aye.
Hopson?
Aye.
Scott?
Aye.
Berger?
Aye.
Williams?
Aye.
Aye. Senate Bill 229 goes to the floor with a due pass. Representative Berger, do you want to carry that?
I'll carry.
Okay,
sure.
Very good. Close the work session on Senate Bill 229. Now we'll take a little more time on Senate Bill 228. Madison, is that you, too?
Yes.
Okay.
And,
give everybody else the day off today, huh?
I got it handled. The Senate Bill 228 is the only one that comes to you today unamended. But, however, it seems like we have three amendments in... package that you have, a -1, -2, and -3. The Senate Bill 228 is a disclosure permission bill, where it gives the authority to the Department of Revenue permitting for disclosure two parts. One part is about the property taxes, and the other part about general disclosure and taxes of the income type. In the ORSs that Senate Bill 228 deals with, it includes the sections that allow the governor and the Office of Economic Analysis, as well as Legislative Revenue Office, to look at these taxes and records. The -1 amendment takes the word of that express by implication type of permission out.
As I recall, that follows up on some conversation we had when we heard this the first time, doesn't it?
That's right.
Deborah, why don't you come on up?
The -2 goes into a detail of explaining what implication is, in a sense. And I think Representative Verger worked on that -2. The -3 expands the sections or the allowable entities and individuals that will be able to receive information to municipal corporations or city, county, and so on, to be able to receive some information from the tax reports. And I believe this comes from Multnomah County. And as all of these still, Mr. Chair, they have no revenue impact to them.
Okay. Deborah Buchanan, we heard this back in March. I think March 10
March,
was the day.
March 7th.
March 7th, okay. So a little refresher might be in order as to the main substance of the bill, and then a lead into your amendments, which are the dash one and dash twos, is that right?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Deborah Buchanan, Department of Revenue. Yes, Mr. Chair, we did hear this bill some time ago. It's dealing with disclosure of information, primarily, sections 2 through 5, and attempting to correct a problem that was inadvertently arising from 1999 legislation and restricting our ability to disclose information to a person who isn't, for example, a certified public accountant or an attorney. During the hearing on the bill, there were concerns raised about the language on page 3, lines 34 and 35 of the bill, and it served as a good reminder that what's in our minds when we use certain words isn't necessarily what is conjured up in someone else's mind. And we worked with Representative Verger on some language to put into the statute more clearly what we mean when we use the words implied consent. And that is what the dash two amendments do. These are modeled on language in an existing administrative rule that discusses implied consent and what we mean by that in disclosing information to a person. So we think this would make this a better bill, more clear as to what those words mean and when we would be authorized to disclose information using implied consent.
Okay. Questions? Representative Verger, go ahead.
I don't have a question. I just want to thank them for working hard because I was very concerned about the implication, and this satisfies me very much.
Well, I guess my question then, Deborah, is if we go with the dash twos, we don't need the dash ones because the dash ones leave expressly or by implication in. That is, if we don't act on the dash ones, we leave expressly or by implication in the bill, and then we put those aside, and then the dash twos define what we mean by implication or what constitutes circumstances suggest implication of authority.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Okay. So we don't need the dash ones if
correct.
We do the dash twos. And you like the dash twos?
I do.
Okay.
I do.
All right. Are there other questions for Deborah on the bill in chief or on either the dash ones or dash twos? Okay. Thank you very much. We have dash threes before us.
I address those as well, Mr. Chair?
I tell you, go ahead, and then we've got three folks from Corvallis and one from Multnomah County. But go ahead, yeah, you give us the overview, I guess, on the threes, and we'll bring them up.
The Dash 3 amendment would allow the department to disclose information to a local government to assist them in administering an income tax that they might adopt. And this really was to assist Multnomah County. They have a measure on the ballot May 20th that would, if passed, impose a local income tax for them to receive information about who is a resident of Multnomah County. They could contact the department or on an after-the-fact basis to verify the taxable income for a person. These amendments would allow us to disclose that information.
Is there any fiscal impact of this to the department? I think that was the concern, at least at one point, whether this was going to have some cost to the department.
If there is any, it would be minimal because we would simply be disclosing information to assist them in the administration of their tax.
Are there questions for Deborah on the dash three?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Berger.
Thank you. Deborah, then would this open the door to any municipality that's contemplating an income tax?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, it would, to the extent that they are imposing a tax on or measured by income and then pursuant to a written agreement protecting the confidentiality of the information. But, yes, it would let us assist Multnomah County. Benton County has expressed some interest in perhaps pursuing income tax.
Or any other county or city in the state?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, it would be any municipal corporation. So, yes, I believe that.
Yeah.
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm assuming that if a county adopted a tax and piggybacked it on the income tax, that that they send out a return and say, put your state number from line such and such here, multiply by that amount, and send us this amount, something like that. What would be the purpose then of this disclosure would be what? To allow them to deal with enforcement issues, or would it be a standard routine thing that you would do with all tax returns? What would be the purpose of it?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, one scenario given to me was that they might ask for a tape of the residents of the county from the Department of Revenue that are filing individual income tax returns so that they would be able to determine mm-hmm. who should be filing.
So they can compare.
Right.
Okay.
And then probably a compliance effort on after the fact. But as to disclosing all the information from the return and for all taxpayers, I don't think we anticipate doing that. It would be as needed for them to administer the tax, so they would need to say, here's what we need and here's why we need it. And
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions for Deborah Buchanan? Are you satisfied with the language municipal corporation? Does that work for counties?
Mr. Chair, I believe it does. John Phillips pointed out the definition of a municipal corporation does include cities and counties.
It does. Okay. Let me make sure we didn't have to bring this. Okay, that's fine. I usually think of cities when I think of municipal corporation, but counties are covered too. Okay? All right. Thank you, Deborah Buchanan. Let's bring up, if we can bring up an extra chair. We've got four folks. Walter Barkin, Dave Boyer, Kathy Rodeman, and Cyril Gable. Why don't you come on up and maybe bring one more chair to the table and we can receive you as a panel. And, okay. Mr. Boyer, why don't you go first, since everyone else is from Benton County, you're from Multnomah County.
Chair Shelley, members of the committee, I'm, for the record, I'm Dave Boyer, Finance Director for Multnomah County, and through the ordinance that was adopted, they have charged me with the administration and collection of the tax if it does pass. And I'll give you a little background. I have worked with the Department of Revenue, met with them several times, called on them, and they have assisted us in getting some information and have been very cooperative. As Deborah pointed out, on May 20th, the voters in Multnomah County will be asked to vote on a personal income tax. And if this is approved, the tax will be based on Oregon taxable income. And having information on residents, the taxable income of a resident in Multnomah County provided by the DOI will assist us in making sure we get the tax statements and forms out to the proper individuals, because some residents that work in Multnomah County do not live in Multnomah County and they will not be taxed. So it's based on residents, and so we want to get the information on residents, and this will help us in the collection, the initial collection, and then enforcement on a follow-up. Multnomah County is working on collecting this tax either internally or through a third party. We're currently talking with the City of Portland. They do our business income tax collection. And also, as mentioned, I've been in conversations with Benton County, City of Corvallis, and the Corvallis School Districts, and they had some interest, and this would also assist them. So appreciate the opportunity to address you and be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Questions for Mr. Boyer? All right. Who's next? Walter? Kathy? Cyril?
Okay. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Walter Barkin. I'm a resident of Benton County and a member of KIDS, a committee of Benton County citizens who have come together in search of a way to mitigate the drastic cuts in public school funding that are anticipated in the coming biennium. Along with citizens in a number of other counties around the state, we believe that a county income tax is the most fair and effective way to achieve this purpose under current circumstances. We are working to place an initiative for such a tax on the Benton County ballot this fall. The new tax revenue is essential for maintaining school programs in Benton County during the 2003-2004 school year. Should the Oregon Department of Revenue be unable to gear up quickly enough to collect the tax for 2003 in the spring of 2004, the Benton County government will have to administer the tax. Because the proposed tax is based on Oregon taxable income, access to state tax return information from residents of Benton County is vital for its effective enforcement. Under current law, state tax returns cannot be shared with county governments. A modest amendment to SB 228 would correct this deficiency. It would also assure the confidentiality of any shared data. And we have some recommended words here, but it sounds as though the Dash 3 amendment that's already on record would serve that purpose. So I urge you to support the addition of this amendment to SB 228 and to pass the measure once it has been amended. Please help the citizens of Benton County and other Oregon counties help themselves by providing this vital tool. Our schools and our children are depending on it. Thank you very much for your cooperation and support.
Okay, let's finish up with the testimony on the panel. Cyril, Gavin?
Okay.
You know, if you want to pull up the microphone there. Catch you on the
okay. Right. I'm also here to speak in favor of the amendment to Senate Bill 228. I'm the chair of the Corvallis School Board, and many of you know that I've been here many times over the past years urging the legislature to adequately address the issues of K-12 funding. We've heard quite clearly from the governor and others of your colleagues this year to not expect the solution to come out of Salem, and that localities really ought to do for themselves. Corvallis faces a $6.2 million deficit next year. Of course, that's on top of the deficits that we absorbed this year and last year and for the past 10 years. Though we have a little over 300 teachers this year, we had over 400 10 years ago, and we have approximately the same number of students. Our deficit that we're facing for next year means we may be losing up to 45 more teachers. So I have been participating in the community effort to look at various local revenue-raising options, and we have settled on a countywide income tax, personal income tax, as the best solution. We're structuring it like Multnomah County in order to make things as simple as possible, and our ultimate hope is that the Department of Revenue would be the collection agency for this. But as Walter mentioned, we've been informed that they probably won't be able to do that as soon as this coming spring, and that we would need to administer the tax ourselves or, you know, through the county. So it's my understanding that the amendment that you're considering would make this possible for us, so I would encourage you to support that.
Yeah. Chair Shetterly, members of the committee, the rest of the panel has already stated our
case. If you could introduce yourself.
Sorry. I'm Kathy Rodman. I'm the business manager for the Corvallis School District, and I'll make it really brief. The rest of the panel has already stated the reasons for this amendment. We're all trying to work together locally to help solve some funding issues for schools, and we need your help. Thank you for the opportunity.
All right. Questions for this panel? No? All right. Thank you very much. Does anybody else wish to testify on Senate Bill 228? Okay, in that case, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 228 and open a work session. Committee, I think we have before us the Dash 2s and 3s appropriately for consideration. I think on the Dash 3s, it's not so much a question of committee's support or opposition for or against any particular local measure, but I guess just recognizing that if a community imposes an income tax on itself, it's a matter of making it administratively feasible to enforce and to collect. So what's your pleasure?
Mr. Chairman, I move Senate Bill 228.
Oh, I'm sorry, we can start with the
Dash 2s. Dash 2, amendments to Senate Bill 228.
All right, Representative Verger moves the Dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 228. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Hearing none. Representative Berger?
Chairman, I move the Dash 3 amendments to Senate Bill 228.
Representative Berger moves the Dash 3 amendments to Senate Bill 228. Is there discussion on that motion? Any objection? Okay. They are in. Representative Berger.
Mr. Chairman, I move Senate Bill 228 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Berger moves Senate Bill 228 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion on that motion? If not, please call the roll.
Representative Barnhart?
Aye.
Berger?
Aye.
Carr?
Aye.
Cass?
Aye.
Thompson?
Aye.
Cass?
Aye.
Berger?
Aye.
Williams?
Aye.
Chair Shetterly?
Aye. Senate Bill 228 as amended goes to the floor with a due pass. We need a carrier on that one. Representative Barnhart, you want that? Got it. Okay. Close the work session on Senate Bill 228 and 13 minutes behind schedule, committee. We are adjourned.
Good job. Okay.